caucus, and I intend to follow the agenda as it was printed. If folks are having any kinds of time problems and you need to speak or ask us to take up consideration out of order, let me know. 2409 is the first bill we've got up. And I believe on behalf of the Legislative Council Office, she may have a statement for us, and we have another witness as well, Mr. Lintott from the Department or the Corporation Division. Ms. Buffet, do you want to come up and talk with us a bit about 2409, please?
Mr. Springer, members of the committee, Kathleen Buffet, Office of Legislative Council. 2409 is what is referred to as the Revisor's Bill, and it is an effort to correct oversights and errors in the Oregon Revised Statutes that have accumulated either because of editorial errors or some errors in enactment. The Corporation Commissioner has handed me a sheet. It's kind of an interesting point. We knew that the word was wrong, and we took a stab at what word we thought should be there, and he's now informing us that our stab was not in the right direction. And so it would appear from this sheet that those are consistent, his suggested changes are consistent with the general overall tone of the bill. If anyone has a specific question about any particular section of the bill, we have a loose leaf notebook with an accumulation of the notes to explain the changes. And you will note that a number of them are gender changes to carry out the legislative policy. I think Ms. Weber has that loose leaf notebook, which gives a specific rationale for each change. That's all I would have to say on the subject.
Okay. Council, did you have anything to add or any particular questions or comments?
No, I didn't.
Okay. Any other questions at this point? If not, thank you. Okay, Mr. Lintott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Robert Lintott, Assistant Corporation Commissioner, and I believe you now have a handout reflecting the suggested changes to House Bill 2409 that come to you from the Corporation Commissioner. Specifically, those include page 5, line 2. Would you prefer that I go through them?
Sure.
Okay. We suggest that you delete the word purchaser and insert salesperson to more specifically reference the people to whom that section refers and with whom it deals. And also on line 4 of page 5, delete the bold printed purchaser and insert salesperson. And in those two sections on page 5, starting lines 6 through 30, change the word broker to broker hyphen dealer. And on page 51, line 34, after the bracket, merely insert 70.075, which would reference to the parallel portion of new chapter 70, which replaced chapter 69 deleted in the last session.
Okay. I think we have those before us. Though this isn't a work session, I don't know if it's going to be necessary to put these in LC form, since we've got LC here, and it would appear that the amendments don't present any significant or substantive issues. Are there any questions for Mr. Lintott? If not, thank you very much. We'll make sure your amendments are considered at our work session. Thank you. Anyone else on 2409? Okay. Next, we've got 2427 relating to discrimination in education. And as the proponents, we've got at least a couple organizations, and representatives of those organizations are here today. Ms. Oser and Ms. Atkins, did you want to come up together? Why not, huh? I know that this matter was considered last session, but because we have obviously new members and people who are new to this committee, and not all of us remember as well as we used to. Why don't you just sort of start from scratch on this one, okay?
Okay.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Sherry Osier, Executive Director of the Oregon Student Lobby. We are one of the requesters of this bill. First, what I'd like to do, if I could, is talk about a little bit about the principle and then go through the bill by section and explain what it does and what the changes are from last session. For those of you who were here last session and this bill was in, the legislature did pass it and it was vetoed by the governor. I should also mention that I worked in the past as equal education specialist at the University of Oregon Affirmative Action Office and can speak to the grievance procedures used on at least that campus regarding discrimination complaints. In the area of education, individuals claiming to be discriminated against on the basis of sex, race, religion, national origin, marital status, age, or handicap have only two avenues of redress: filing a suit in federal court as permitted by federal legislation, or seeking administrative relief with the determination and enforcement controlled by education agencies themselves. Current state law, allows an individual to file a suit in state court for other types of illegal discrimination, but not for discrimination in education. Just as an example, employment discrimination, public accommodations, housing are all cases where people of this state
Mr.
can...
Chair. Excuse me, Representative Hanlon.
I got a question on this bill. How come we got all new language and all new sections? If I recall, isn't there a provision that already speaks to what you can and can't do in court? And isn't it 659121? And why are we doing patchwork without dealing with existing law? If you can, in the course of your testimony, address that, I'd like it addressed.
Certainly.
Okay.
Employees of educational institutions have the right to file under Oregon's unlawful employment statutes. The real issue addressed in this particular bill is the lack of any explicit statutory private right of action for students who believe they've been illegally discriminated against. Our purpose in requesting introduction of this bill is to ensure all appropriate remedies are available to students, just as all remedies are available to citizens of this state in other cases. Now, what I'd like to do is go through this bill briefly and talk about the provisions of it. Subsection 1 allows any person in education to go to circuit court for equitable relief, damages, or both. The court may order relief as may be appropriate. Representative Hanlon, if I understood your question, currently there is no private right of action in education. In the civil rights statutes, there is discrimination. There's a section on discrimination in education. It is, I believe, two sections long. It's ORS 659.150 and 155. It does not have private right of action, as do other civil rights statutes, such as unlawful employment or housing. In ORS Chapter 30, there is a cause of action for discrimination in public accommodations. Subsection 2 of the bill requires that any suit or action authorized by this section be filed within 1 year of the date of the alleged discrimination. Subsection 3, and this is where it's slightly different from last time. Subsection 3 provides that there is a 90-day waiting period
after a grievance has been filed, before a suit may be filed. In the legislation in 1985, there was a distinction made between those cases where there was a grievance filed and was when there was not a grievance filed. There was still a 90-day waiting period. There's really a deferral period. So if a suit was filed, the court had to defer action for 90 days. What this committee, in fact, did was to change that. And that concept has been put in this version of the bill. So one, it requires that a grievant file a complaint. The educational agencies will have 90 days after the complaint has been filed to go through their administrative process. If after that 90 days, the educational agencies have not either made a conciliation agreement with the grievant or made a final determination of the grievance, then the grievant could go to circuit court and file a suit. The waiting period and the requirement that a grievance be filed are provided to accommodate the good faith administrative efforts in resolving discrimination complaints. Subsection 3 also allows a grievant to seek injunctive relief. Injunctive relief in subsection 3, excuse me, is also independent of the right to pursue any administrative remedy. That's the other change from the 1985 version, where it was the right to private right of action, a right to go to court essentially at any time, rather than just for injunctive relief. In subsection 4, there are two instances where no suit may be filed. One, if the education agency has obtained a conciliation agreement with the grievant, or two, if the agency has made a final determination of the grievance. Under present administrative procedures, what happens if an agency has already investigated the complaint and made a final determination, if the grievant does not agree with the findings, the only remedy they have is to appeal that decision to the Court of Appeals. Court of Appeals, there is very limited, the review of the Court of Appeals is very limited in scope. And one, I would like to read from the Attorney General's Administrative Law Manual. This is when a case has been referred or appealed to the Court of Appeals from an administrative procedures proceeding. The Attorney General says, the review of the Court of Appeals is not intended to second-guess the substantive decision-making of the agency. Rather, the Court's review is limited to ensure that the agency followed the prescribed procedure, including the agency's own rules in making its decision, correctly interpreted the applicable laws, acted on the basis of adequate evidence in the record, and did not abuse its discretion. They do not look at the facts of the case. They do not look at whether or not discrimination occurred, for example. Subsection 5 allows the court, if the defendant prevails, to award the defendant costs and reasonable attorney fees if the court finds that the action was frivolous. This provision is included to answer concerns expressed in the past regarding frivolous lawsuits. One other thing I should mention is that I know this committee and the legislature has been concerned about court costs in the past, having other causes of action, having a lot of people go into the judicial system and the cost that that has on the system. During the last session, the fiscal office did put out a fiscal impact of this bill. This bill is even more limited than last session's bill. The fiscal impact that they found was minimal in the case of higher education, the community colleges, and elementary and secondary schools. I don't think this is going to be a burden on the court system.
Sure.
Could I ask, excuse me, at this point, it would be helpful if you could, do you remember the bill number from 85? Do you have a copy of that handy?
I don't have a copy handy. It was Senate Bill 413.
Senate Bill 413. Okay. We may have to, I don't know how easy it is to get some of that materials, but whatever you can share with us, be appreciated.
I have copies of all the versions, and I would be happy to give you all the versions.
I didn't mean to cut off your discussion. You had some additional remarks you wanted to make at this point?
Only that we believe that this is an important piece of legislation. Far too often, administrative remedies are inadequate to meet the needs of the complainant. Unfortunately, one of the people who testified last time was one I believe is unable to appear today. That's Jane Aiken, who has had a complaint with the state system of higher education that is still open for 10 years. It was first filed in 1977. She, at the time, was an undergraduate student. She has since graduated, gone to law school, and is now a practicing attorney. The reason she could not be here today is she had a court case this afternoon, but I think she would be happy to provide you with information about her complaint at any future time.
Okay. Representative Hamlin?
Who is this, the potential group of plaintiffs that might take advantage of this, the filing of such a lawsuit? Does it include the janitor at the school district, the teacher, superintendent, in addition to the student body?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamlin, our intent is to have anyone that the discrimination in education statute applies to have them come under this. However, if, for example, the janitor or someone else in a school district had an employment-related case, it is much more likely that they would use the employment statutes rather than this, because they do not have an exhaustion of administrative remedies to go through, as this bill doesn't necessarily mean it's an exhaustion of administrative remedies, but they do have that 90-day wait, where they do not have that wait under the employment statutes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hamlin.
Would this suit preclude someone from going to any court until filing a grievance and waiting 90 days?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamlin, yes.
So
as it's presently written.
So if I had some other contractual right to go to court, I'd still have to come in under this bill and file a grievance and wait 90 days if I were the janitor?
Representative Hamlin, that would probably depend on which law that you were going to use. If it were a discrimination in employment case, I don't believe you would have to wait the 90 days. That particular statute does not require a 90-day wait.
But this discrimination in education does.
That's correct.
So there's no possibility a court would interpret it differently and require throw somebody out of court on a labor case because of this language on discrimination in education?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamlin, I would never guess at what a court might interpret.
Representative Hamlin? Fine. Terry, I'm having a little trouble maybe trying to fit together the time deadlines here.
Sure.
I'm assuming that this action, if brought, probably would require a tort claim notice. Is since we're talking about a public agency or political subdivision. So that means that one-time deadline that that person or that person's attorney is going to have to meet is filing that within 180 days. So that's one time frame that has to be met. And then you talk about, then when you get down to sub three, you talk about a suit or action shall be filed not less than 90 days after a grievance has been filed, except when only injunctive relief is sought. I'm kind of curious just how that fits in with the 180-day provision and the one-year provision, and just what the real timelines are. I mean, how this is going to work.
Representative Springer, the first in subsection 2 requires the grievant to file the complaint or to file the suit within 1 year. So they have, from the time of the incident, from the 1 year.
Well, let's take a for instance. Let's say that somebody felt they were discriminated against. Yes. They went to register on January 1st, and they're told, no, we're not going to let you register because you're a woman. I mean, something that seems pretty obvious, right? Okay, that happens on January 1st of this year. Can you kind of tell me what's got to happen and what the timeline is for the
sure.
next year if that person wants to pursue an action or a grievance or whatever?
Sure. The first thing they would do under this bill is probably file for injunctive relief in that instance.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they're not admitted at that point in time, they're going to have to wait for 3 months until the next term starts. They can do that under this bill. They would still have to file a grievance with the institution. The institution would still have 90 days to investigate and make some determination of the complaint. If they did not complete that in 90 days, then you could go back and file a suit in circuit court. If you didn't get, essentially, I guess, if you didn't get what you wanted to get out of injunctive relief.
Okay. Let me try this scenario. Let's say that this person, for whatever reasons, has given a tort claim notice 180 days out. Let's say June 30th, that person says, or at least by that date, that person has written to the particular institution and said, hey, I may be filing an action against you. Let's say that person, for whatever reason, waits until 300 days, sometime, say, around November 1st, before that person files a grievance. And then there's a 90-day waiting period, and if I understand the language here, as this is written, correct me if I'm wrong, if that person didn't start the grievance until 60 days from the end of the year, that person could be barred from filing an action. Is that a correct reading of this?
Representative Springer, that probably is true in my reading. Gene may want to comment.
It just seems like it procedurally could be a little tricky and ergo turn into a trap for somebody. But
Mr. Chairman, Gene Atkins, lobbyist for the Women's Rights Coalition. I think it is possible that some kind of a tolling provision could help that problem, that if you did not file your grievance, that the time period would be tolled during the period that your grievance was in process, if in fact you didn't file your grievance that period of time. The other possibility, of course, is to back up the requirement to file the grievance to a time prior to that. Either way, that probably is a potential problem for agreement.
Okay. Are there any further questions at this point? You wanted to testify, I know, but why don't we go ahead and take your testimony and let's see if there are further questions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Jean Atkins, lobbyist for the Women's Rights Coalition. I will say, since this is the first time before my first time before this particular subcommittee, that the Women's Rights Coalition is made up of 59 statewide and local organizations committed to legal and economic equality for women. The goal of House Bill 2427, creation of a private right of action for victims of discrimination in education, was adopted by our membership, those organizations, last December as a leading issue on WRC's legislative agenda. We have therefore joined the Oregon Student Lobby as co-requesters of this bill. Since the 1970s, great strides have been made in increasing opportunities for young women in education. From elementary through secondary and on into college, women and girls are now, by and large, not overtly prevented from entering education programs, barred from extracurricular activities, or limited by quota from receiving financial aid. This is largely due to the effectiveness of both state and federal statutes requiring non-discrimination in publicly funded education. But discrimination is never completely eliminated, and as school budgets shrink and students' needs change, erosion of the gains made over the last 10 years are quite possible. Budget cuts threaten the substantial growth of women's athletic programs, for instance, at all levels. The computer science courses and programs of the 1980s are as dominated by boys as were the vocational education and shop classes of the early 1970s. Civil rights enforcement at both the federal and state levels has traditionally encompassed two remedies. Nearly every anti-discrimination statute provides for an administrative remedy, and failing resolution of that claim, an opportunity to have the courts review the complaint. The federal law prohibiting sex discrimination in education provides both potential remedies, as do both the state laws and federal laws prohibiting discrimination in employment. The education statute that we seek to amend with this bill does not allow any remedy in court. Furthermore, the only administrative remedy allowed is through the state school systems themselves, not through an independent agency of any kind. While I am sure that schools themselves, school boards, and the state school boards have in the past and will again effectively resolve some of the claims of discrimination that come to their attention, they are not the ideal forum for hearing such complaints. In many instances, they are the initiators of the discrimination itself through their adoption of curriculum, extracurricular, or discipline policies. Parents or students who come before these officials with concerns about fair treatment are put very much at a disadvantage. They must, in effect, convince school officials that they have acted out of bias, a message people rarely like to hear and seldom want to admit. With no option beyond appeal to others in the education establishment, complainants have very little negotiating power. Very significant to your consideration of this bill in this session of the legislature is the fact that the federal law that I referred to earlier, Title IX, is essentially dormant at this time. A Supreme Court decision a few years ago severely constricted the federal government's jurisdiction to review school actions. It is therefore particularly important that an effective state remedy be in place, and it gives Oregon an opportunity to recapture a civil rights enforcement role that was, for the most part, dominated by the federal government throughout the 1970s. Women's Rights Coalition believes this bill addresses a specific and very real problem. 23 complaints of discrimination against schools in the state of Oregon were filed with the federal government over the past 5 years. On the other hand, we do not believe this bill will open the floodgates to massive numbers of lawsuits. As far as I can determine, none of those 23 complaints resulted in litigation, although that alternate avenue was available to those people. A private right of action is a tool which will be used very sparingly, but which gives school officials increased reason to take claims of discrimination seriously. Thank you. I'd like to just briefly respond a little bit to the question of Representative Hamlin about others than students encompassed by this bill. Obviously, while the bill on its face does not exclude others discriminated against, I think there is an election of remedies issue here that Sherry was speaking to, that in fact remedies are probably more effective, more expedient, and more lots of other things for employment-related claims under other statutes. They already have that sort of a remedy available to them. And further, I think that ORS 659.150, which addresses discrimination in education, has always, correct me if I'm wrong, been intended to apply to the problems of educational programs and their impact on students and school officials and their relationship with students, as opposed to employment-related issues or other kinds of things. If there is a need to make that explicit in this bill, I think that may be possible, and we would want to discuss that, but it is a fair question.
Okay. We have your written statement, of course, too, which is made part of the record. Any further questions? I don't know who helped you with drafting this or came up with the language, but but one question I did note at the bottom is we always get into trouble, I think, when we don't prescribe an effective date and say whether or not this is going to apply to, you know, causes of action which accrue or things which are filed or things which take place on or before a certain date. So I would like your suggestion in terms of how we deal with an effective date. So, because it's better to have done this consciously than just to wait for whatever the normal effective date would be 90 days after signee die. It's better sometimes to pick a date certain and then make sure it specifically applies to what categories of cases or where things may be at in the process. So appreciate your suggestion when we come back to this subject of work session. Anything else for either of these two witnesses? Okay, if not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have, I believe, a written statement that we received from Steve Nelson. Is Mr. Nelson here today? If not, we have received from Mr. Nelson on this bill a statement from him. He identifies himself as student body president of the University of Oregon, and he supports the bill as it's been introduced. Our next witnesses are Melinda Greer from the State Department of Higher Education.
Representative Springer and members of the committee, I've submitted to you testimony, and I won't bother you by reading that again. If you'd like to look over it, I'd like to just give you a few comments. Basically, we are...
Don't take that personally, Senator.
No.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Senator Jeanette Hamby, District 5. I'm here before you today regarding House Bill 2021. Joint Interim Committee on Hazardous Materials requested the introduction of this bill as a way of more completely protecting the interests of Oregonians in the event of a nuclear incident. As a member of the Interim Committee, I supported this bill. And to further clarify the record, Mike McCracken, of course, was unable to be here, so he quickly asked me to come over from the Senate side. So,
okay, thank you. I should note, just before you continue, Senator, that we have this bill and the next bill because we borrowed them pursuant to House rules from the House E&E Committee, to which they've been originally referred, and we asked to bring them up here because they do touch on some liability issues.
Correct.
Which are traditionally issues that get discussed in Judiciary Committee as well. So we thought it only fair to take a look and comment as appropriate. Excuse me. Thank you, Senator.
This one, of course, is significant liability.
Right.
This bill does a number of things. The changes to existing statutes are primarily designed to assure that Oregon laws not be an implement to full compensation under the Price-Anderson Act in the event of a nuclear incident. Section 1 sets the statute of limitations for commencement of an action for damages from a nuclear incident. The important distinction here is that injury in such a case may not be evident until many years after the incident itself. The latency period for a radiation-induced cancer can be, as you know, 20 to 30 years after exposure. If a 3 or 6 year limitation were placed on this type of event, as may be typical in other injury cases, the injured party might not yet know of the actual injury. Section 2 places a 30-year overall limitation on an action for damages so that it not be left open-ended. Section 3 establishes strict liability for any person who uses nuclear material for harm resulting from that use. This, too, is meant as a protection for those who might be injured. Nuclear technology is a highly complex field, and it would be very difficult indeed for someone without the resources of the nuclear industry to prove negligence in design or action. In addition, an accident that would meet the proof of causation standard of Section 4 would be a significant one. If the consequences of such an accident were severe, damages would be more fairly charged to the parties that stand to profit from the activities, even if there is no negligence involved. Section 4 then establishes the proof of causation for a nuclear incident. Because radiation-induced cancers cannot be distinguished from non-radiation-induced cancers, the injured party must have a tool to evaluate the injury. This standard would allow an injured party to claim damages if their injury was more likely than not caused by the nuclear incident. In other words, if there was more than a 51% chance that the injury was radiation-induced, a claim could be made. Section 5 and 6 make the necessary changes to ORS Chapter 12 to be consistent with the policies set forth in the earlier sections of the bill. Section 7 and 8 make necessary additions to definitions in ORS Chapter 30. Section 9 and 10 allow injured parties to make claims against all public jurisdictions, including the state of Oregon. This provision is important because under some circumstances, a public body may be at fault for part of the damages arising from a nuclear incident. In such a case, Oregon's sovereign immunity should not be an impediment to an injured party making a claim, as long as the Price-Anderson coverage were available. Section 11 would make sure that any natural catastrophe need not be a defense from strict liability as long as Price-Anderson coverage is available. And finally, Section 12 would allow all governmental agencies to recover the cost of responding to an accident involving nuclear materials. As I mentioned before, Mr. Chairman, the bill is truly complex and it draws from many fields, including physics and law. And because of this, I've asked Dave Stewart Smith of the Oregon Department of Energy to be here with me to answer any questions. He was, by the way, a tremendous asset to us in the interim committee. It's an issue that we have addressed. Both Mike and I have been House and Senate members, representatives to the Western State Council of Governments, where this issue has been addressed also extensively. But Dave is the one to really respond to any nitty-gritty questions that you might have. Dave?
I'm available for any questions the committee might have.
Representative Hanlon.
Why? Senator Hamby, I think this is for you. Why do we call this stuff incidents instead of catastrophes?
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanlon, in part that is because the term nuclear incident is defined in the Price-Anderson federal legislation, and the bill refers back to USC 42 to get that definition.
One further, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Section 4 relates the standard causation test, as I understand it, in Oregon courts of law as it presently exists. Is there some reason for its necessity in the bill because of Price-Anderson? And additionally, when does Price-Anderson come up for reauthorization? What's the talk about what's going on nowadays?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanlon, Price-Anderson is up for review this session of Congress. It's up for review every 10 years since 1957, so it's up again for the third time. The Section 4 proof of causation is in this bill to make sure that such evidence as epidemiological studies and information about the statistical chance of contracting a cancer, the 51% argument, be an acceptable piece of evidence in court. It may not be necessary under Oregon law, but that was not clear to those of us that were dealing with this issue in the interim, so we wanted to make sure that that type of evidence be acceptable in a court proceedings.
One more, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
What are the limits on liability for a nuclear catastrophe, and what are the limits that are being talked about under Price-Anderson?
Under Price-Anderson. Mr. Chair, Representative Hanlon, current limits under Price-Anderson are $500 million for the federal government and $640 million for a federal licensee, a nuclear reactor. That limit goes up by, I believe, $30 million every time a new power reactor comes online. It automatically is raised $30 million because much of the coverage is industry-wide. There are several issues being talked about in Congress as to possible lids on that limitation, and much of the talk is raising it perhaps as high as $1 billion from its current 650. But my sense is they haven't settled on a number yet. So I don't really know what the best guess is right now.
Representative Hanlon?
Well, just to clarify that, you said $500 million for the federal government and $640 million is the pool established by the different online nuclear facilities. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So I don't add them together and get $1.1 billion? As the limit on one
no.
event, I take half. I don't understand how that works. I just,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanlon, I'm not sure it's all that clear to me either. But I think the bill anticipates an incident where the federal government would be liable, being a separate incident from where a utility perhaps would be liable. I don't think those are meant to be added together. Okay. I know that the Price-Anderson bill specifically does not allow. For example, each power reactor has to carry $160 million in liability insurance through one of the nuclear insurance pools, and Price-Anderson does not allow those insurance limits to be added together to equal more than the lid on Price-Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any further questions? I'm a little curious why in Section 9 it was necessary to take out some of the current language that relates to the Tort Claim Act, particularly the definition of what a tort claim is about. I know you folks may not have drafted this, but if you do have any information.
I had that down at one time. That was a change made by legislative counsel, and it wasn't part of the information that was discussed during the interim. I'm not exactly sure why that deletion was made.
Okay.
Except I think it's referred to in a different section.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask our counsel to follow up with legislative counsel to see why they chose to do that.
Jeanette Holman was the individual that drafted the
okay.
bill.
Maybe also I'll ask counsel if we could get a couple of copies of a U.S. code that's referenced in the existing law as well as in the new language. We don't have that in front of us, unfortunately. I'd just like to have that available for review.
Mr. Chairman, I also alerted Jeanette Holman to the fact that this hearing was being held today, and she said she would be in. If you would like to speak with her, I can notify her, and she can be up here in a few minutes to answer some of those questions, if you'd like.
Well, we're going to take a break here in a few minutes. What we can do is call and see if she's available to come up to respond. I'm sorry, did we get your name on the record and with whom you're associated?
Excuse me, I'm not sure we did. My name is David Stewart Smith. I'm the manager of the Radioactive Materials Program for the Oregon Department of Energy.
And do I understand that this is basically a model act that's being adopted across the western states?
Yes. The suggestions for amendments to state law have been put together by the staff of the Western Interstate Energy Board. Mm-hmm. These suggestions this bill is basically from those suggestions.
Great. Any further questions? Okay, we do have another witness here from the Department of Justice, so let's hear what Mr. Perry has to say, Wallace Perry. And I think we have some written statements from Mr. Perry also to share with members. We'll go ahead and distribute those this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You do have a written statement, and I won't bother to read it to you at this point. It is basically a summary of the bill and an explanation of some of the sections. I represent the Department of Energy, and I was asked by them to be available to the committee to answer any questions about the implementation of this. I can address some of the questions that you've raised with the previous witnesses.
Sure.
If I might. The question of whether or not the You could add together the $500 and $600 million dollars raised by Representative Hanlon. I believe those sections are exclusive of each other. The $600 million goes to nuclear power plants run by utilities, and the $500 million is indemnity provided by the federal government for other types of facilities, so there would be no overlap between those two different coverages.
Okay, thank you.
The question of the definition of tort, why it was removed, I believe was because a definitional section was created in Section 8 in order to define a nuclear incident, and apparently Legislative Council thought it would be appropriate to put in the definition of tort in that section just for clarity. That's in the bottom of page 2. So I think that's the explanation for that deletion in Section 9.
Okay, just a relocation, I guess, is what you're saying.
That's correct.
Okay, thanks for pointing that out. We do have your written comments with some background information on the Price-Anderson Act. And it would appear to me, Mr. Perry, that we haven't done anything to our existing state substantive law in terms of the burden of proof or generally the statute of limitations or how we deal with strict liability, but just made it maybe specifically applicable to nuclear incidents as they're defined under federal law. Is that a fair summation?
I think so, Mr. Chairman. It does specifically set out that strict liability will be the standard in a case involving a nuclear incident, and does somewhat lengthen the statutes of limitations which would otherwise be applicable.
If we didn't have the 30 years, we'd be bound by what, the 8-year period of ultimate repose?
I believe it's 6 years for actions involving property, and I'm not sure what it is for personal injuries.
Okay. And we have basically the discovery rule, which applies as well as a general rule to other kinds of actions in this state.
That's correct.
Okay. Any further questions for Mr. Perry? Did you assist in the drafting of this, sir? Or?
No, I did not.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate your availability today. Anyone else on 2021? Yes? Okay.
My name is Barry Gross, for the record, and I represent Union Pacific Railroad Company. I hadn't intended to testify today, and I don't have any prepared testimony. I would like to say that we have some concerns about House Bill 2021 that we haven't fully developed because we haven't had a chance to analyze it fully. I haven't been able to send it to my principals back in Omaha and have them look at it. But one thing it seems to me that is clear is that the bill, or the intent of the bill, the thrust of it seems to be towards nuclear utilities and imposing strict liability on them and the insurance pool that they have available under the Price-Anderson Act.
Mr. Chair, I might just mention, I have a concern about the safety of transportation of these materials too, and it was my thought that these kinds of things were being addressed.
If I might continue. Certainly there is a safety aspect involved in the transportation of nuclear materials. However, it's not clear to me that the standard of care imposed upon a transporter of nuclear material should be strict liability when the transporter is but a common carrier that is required by law to ship those goods tendered to it. Under law, we cannot refuse a shipment of nuclear material strictly because it is nuclear in nature, and therefore it puts us in the position of being forced to accept a shipment that, if given the choice, we might not take because of the inherent liability risks, and yet it burdens us with the standard of strict liability should anything occur. We are willing and accept the responsibility for our own acts of negligence, as we should, but we question whether under the, since we are forced to transport these goods as a common carrier, we should be held to the strict liability standard that might be applicable to those that choose to go into the field of producing nuclear energy, for example.
Wouldn't you have a right of indemnification, contractually or otherwise?
I don't know that that's true, and if we have a fly-by-night outfit that's shipping with us, it may not do any good anyway.
I don't pretend to know anything about this area of the law, but I recognize that you folks potentially could be caught up on the horns of the strict liability. Let me just explain the procedure to you here, Mr. Gross. We are borrowing this bill from the Environment and Energy Committee under our House rules. We have it up here, I believe, for a period of 10 days. The most that we can do is comment or make recommendations to the committee to which it was originally referred and which continues to have primary jurisdiction. We're going to have a follow-up hearing, I believe, in approximately a week on both of these bills. I don't know if that's going to be time for you to have your information back to us. If it is, we'd be glad to hear from you further at that time. If not, we're not going to have any choice but to return this to the E&E committee. I'm sure they would then schedule it for hearings, and you would have an opportunity, I would hope, I would expect down there to make this presentation as well. And they would be in a position to make actual amendments to the bill. We can make recommendations, but we can't really amend the bill as such. So that's just the way by which we're having this hearing today is a little bit out of the normal course, but I thought that hopefully will be helpful to you.
I think that that would provide us plenty of opportunity to address our concerns.
Okay. I don't know if you had any written comments you wanted to share with us today.
No, I didn't. As I said, I've come a little bit unprepared, but I thought I better get up here and say something in case this was the last opportunity we had.
Okay. Now, Ms. Weber, this is scheduled again for, do you remember the date?
March 2nd.
March 2nd. So it's coming up relatively soon. If you have some information for us at that time, either in writing or personally, if you want to appear again, we'd certainly be glad to give you that opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any further questions? Representative Hanlon.
Yes. Section 3 certainly appears to take into account transportation, but just a comment. I note that we have, and I don't know the gentleman. I've never seen him before today, but I just would remind the railroad industry that during the last session I introduced a bill regarding railroads and the benefits and special privileges that they've acquired from the 1890s forward within the Oregon Revised Statute that said should they unreasonably abandon railroads, especially in the rural areas, that they should be treated like any other citizen or person of the state rather than have all of the special privileges granted them since the 1890s. I really don't think railroads should get any particular special privileges in addition to those they've accrued over the years, especially in this era of deregulation where it's all take and no give on their side of the bargaining stick. Sorry, Mr. Chairman, I had to.
So noted for the record. Mr. Gross, we don't expect you to have to respond necessarily.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, you and the good representative want to pursue this further, please feel free. And if not, we'll look forward to seeing it at our next hearing.
Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else on 2021? Okay, if not, we've got 2026. Now, for reasons not entirely clear, no one has signed up to testify in 2026. Well, why not, Mr. Donica? We don't get to see you very often. Why don't you come on up and talk to us a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, Tom Donica for Associated Oregon Industries. You will, however, note that the bill is an interim committee bill, not our bill. But I think I attended those committee hearings, and I think I can tell you what the committee was thinking about. I'm not surprised somebody isn't here either from DEQ or from the interim committee to speak to it. What we have today in the state of Oregon is a true lack of knowledgeable people in the field of hazardous materials and hazardous waste. And the smaller you are, the more difficult the law and the regulations are.
Mr. Chair, I just didn't hear. True what and what of? I'm sorry.
The number of, the smaller the company, the less likely they are to be able to handle the current law and regulations, to understand them and be able to comprehend them. Stack about that high. It is difficult and it is complex. A number of companies, some of whom are members of AOI, some of whom are not, have been, as a matter of fact, providing information to these small generators as to how to handle this. DEQ, frankly, can only do a limited amount of this. They do not have staffing to be able to deal with all the small people either. As a matter of fact, in many cases, they don't even know who they are yet. So what you have is a situation where a number of companies who have been providing this information on advice of counsel have ceased doing this. We don't think this is necessarily in the public interest, but nonetheless, there is the concern that the small company, which basically has not got the financial resources, could conceivably either misuse the information or may not have disclosed all the information, and a problem could arise in the larger company having given the advice and not perhaps on the standard of ordinary negligence may have erred in not getting all of the information, but in these cases, many cases, the small generator isn't fully aware of what he's doing either. So what the bill is an attempt to do is simply to absolve those companies who give that kind of advice from a standard of ordinary negligence and raise it to a standard of gross negligence. Understand that the problem that is out there in terms of the particular hazardous waste regulations, they are complex for generators. We're not talking about those who only generate 2,200 pounds a month or less. They come in two kinds. One, the small quantity generator, who is regulated differently than somebody who produces more than that, who's fully regulated.
Mr.
If you
Chair,
produce less than 200 pounds, you're not subject to any regulation, but you still have... Yes?
Excuse me, Representative Hanlon.
Tom, you said that this changes it from ordinary negligence to gross negligence.
Yeah.
And I look... Are we on House Bill 2026?
Yeah, and I'm looking at Section 4.
Okay.
You look at Section 3, too.
Will you explain the effect of Section 2 in coordination with 4?
I'm sorry. Representative Hanlon, you said...
What does it mean, no person may maintain an action for damages against a person who voluntarily provides?
Voluntarily, I assume, is...
Forget the voluntarily. No person may maintain an action for damages against a person.
Voluntarily. It's voluntarily is a key and critical word.
Well, forget that. What does that phrase mean? You can't bring any kind of lawsuit, period.
Under that section, but it's modified by Sections 3 and Section 4. Section 3 says, yeah, but if you were otherwise liable, this bill is not going to protect you. And if it wasn't voluntary, in other words, if you received income or monetary reward other than just your actual expenses, that's not voluntary. So it's got to be free and for no gain given, and you can't otherwise be liable because of having participated in some way other than that, either through a joint ownership situation or perhaps because you provided the materials that were used and which went astray and caused the contamination. It is not unlike a bill that was passed last session. It was House Bill 2338 of the last session. But that on a different subject matter.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. In this process, we make things needlessly complex. And Mr. Donica says it is not unlike a bill that passed last session. I need 10 minutes to figure out the connotations of the inverted negatives that he's using, and I can't figure out how Section 2 and 4 go together in this bill.
I don't know who drafted this. I think Tom is not telling us that he drafted it.
I didn't draft it.
That's what you get for being a volunteer, Mr. Donegan, as you probably noticed.
In any event, we would support the concept, and we think that there's something there in the whole field of hazardous waste generation, and again, a very complex piece of law that you ought to look at, because there's more benefit than there is harm here.
Who is the staff person to that joint interim committee, Tom, do you recall?
You mean the ledge counsel was Jeanette
Holman?
Yeah.
Okay. We may contact the administrator or maybe ask someone from that committee to come up and talk to us. I don't know how much discussion they gave this particular bill, if any, or if they prepared an actual report. I guess another question is if other states are following the same course, et cetera, et cetera.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know.
Okay. Thanks again, Tom. Appreciate it. Anyone else on 2026? Yes, sir.
For the record, my name is Marion Hemphill. I'm the director of the Oregon PUD Association. That's the People's Utility District Association. One of the things that came to light this morning, I was talking to one of my managers about this particular bill, and admittedly, I did not follow this during the interim, and it is new to me. But the question arose, inasmuch as I agree with Mr. Donica, that many of the generators, the small-scale generators in particular, are without technical expertise in this particular area, and they do rely on advice from others. The question that was posed to me, and I don't have an answer for it, but I will pose it in relationship to this bill, is we oftentimes rely on vendors for particular information on how to manage certain situations because they're supposedly the industry experts, they're selling us the products, they're selling us the services, and so on and so forth. The question was posed to us as to if we would happen to ask a vendor for advice on a particular item or action, and it was incorrect, and it led to a hazardous situation, that we had relied upon that advice and took action based upon that advice, why that individual should, or that company that he represents, be held harmless in this situation. That's all that I have. It is a question, and you as attorneys and so on and so forth should have a better idea of this than I, but it certainly did raise a question among my managers this morning.
Okay, I'm trying to think of some of the fact scenarios. Can you maybe give me a for instance in terms, I'm not sure I know what a small generator is. It talks about the definition here, person, and I assume we mean a natural person or any other kind of person for purposes of the law, that generates less than 2,200 pounds, so I guess you could do 2,199 pounds of hazardous waste a month. To me, you know, there's not much about that. That seems like a fairly significant amount of hazardous waste. Now, maybe it's not. It says 2 pounds or less of acutely hazardous waste a month. I mean, is plutonium an acutely hazardous waste?
We don't...